High resolution color graphics.
This land of high technology.
The revolution in technology that made the information age possible.
Those kids are not afraid of computers.
Welcome to This Week in Retro for the week of September the 7th, 2020. Coming up on today's show,
a new console for your oscilloscope.
The Sinclair C5 makes a return.
Celebrating the 35th anniversary of Super Mario Brothers.
Ranking the 20 greatest home computers.
Sid Meier's memoir.
And is it okay to spray paint retro computers?
All this and more on This Week in Retro.
Up-to-date news
for out-of-date tech.
Neil, if you bought an oscilloscope during a late-night eBay binge and it's been gathering dust unused in a corner, get ready to pull it out and fire it up. Hardware wizard TubeTime has engineered a vector graphic console for your poor, unused, or used oscilloscope, and it's called Scopatrex. The Scopatrex is actually a clone of the Vectrex console, the unique 1982 all-in-one system with a vector screen. So it makes perfect sense to pair it up with an oscilloscope. Neil, do you have an oscilloscope?
I certainly do. It doesn't get a huge amount of use here on the channel because anyone who watches me knows I'm a break-fix kind of a guy. I'm not a highly trained electronics engineer, so it tends not to go much further than things like, is this crystal oscillator still oscillating? So it's a useful tool, but one that requires you to have a deep understanding of what you're looking at. So it's really the multimeter here that gets much more use in the first instance. But I should point out that this idea of a game on an oscilloscope is certainly not a new thing. One of the very first video games ever created, and some consider it to be the first, was Tennis for Two in 1958. And this is a game which displays a tennis court from a side view. It's two players, and you use a dial to adjust the angle of your tennis shot, and then you press a button to try and hit the ball. And all of this was displayed on an oscilloscope at the Brookhaven National Laboratory's annual public exhibition event for 3 days in that year of 1958. And it was super popular with crowds. So oscilloscope games are pretty much as retro gaming gets, John.
Yeah, if you read any of the history of video gaming books, Tennis for Two is always in chapter one. I think that it only makes sense because an oscilloscope was a display that you could easily manipulate. So, I think that an oscilloscope is fertile ground for a new retro console, especially one that is the clone of a Vectrex. Now, the Scopatrex actually introduces a number of enhancements to the original Vectrex board, including a single 5-volt power supply, configurable brightness, and easily sourceable parts. If you've ever tried to source parts for a Vectrex, it is not something that's easy to do. Once completed, all you need to do is flash the ROM onto the memory chip and you're good to go. So you can actually build this up from scratch if you get that custom PCB. Neil, do you have a favorite Vectrex game?
Well, for this kind of setup, I would go for a modern game actually that's called Player 2, which was released, I think it was last year, by Jubbernaut. Because on the Vectrex, there is a distinct lack of two-player games. And Player 2 is a compilation purely of two-player games, co-op and head-to-head games. And I think that would make for the perfect tribute to the game I mentioned earlier, Tennis for Two on an oscilloscope. So I'll go for Jubbernaut's Player 2.
I think that's a great choice. I'd have to go with Pole Position. I think there's something special about the way that you have a scrolling screen with the vector graphics. It's something that looks totally retro and totally awesome. Neil, this thing couldn't have come along at a more convenient time because Vectrex consoles are going through the roof. I remember about 10 years ago, I had the opportunity to buy one of these for around $75. I checked eBay. These things are going all day for $400 and up. So if you don't have that kind of scratch and you're handy with a soldering iron, check out the Scopatrex and you can build one of these yourself. You can check out the link in the GitHub page in the show notes. And if you build one, send us a pic. Thanks to EOC Phantom for submitting this story on our subreddit.
The Sinclair C5 makes a return. Some called him crazy, others a visionary, but whatever you thought of British inventor Sir Clive Sinclair, he did deliver a personal electric vehicle in 1985 in the form of the Sinclair C5. It was essentially a recumbent bicycle with an open-top cockpit, just large enough for one person, and a battery-powered motor which turned one of the rear wheels to drive it. But pedals were also a part of the design, partly because the motor was very weak and needed some assistance from your legs to get up those steep hills. And also the whole design was engineered to avoid road tax and the need for a driver's license. So it was essentially classed as a bicycle. The C5 was a commercial flop in 85, but that hasn't stopped nephew of Sir Clive, Grant Sinclair, from giving it another go. His Iris e-trike is now taking pre-orders, and it promises a 30-mile range at up to 30 miles an hour. It has a weatherproof canopy and, like the C5, pedal assistance to ensure no license is required to drive it on the roads. So, John, is now the right time for a Sinclair C5?
Well, before I answer, I just, whenever this story came up, I immediately thought back to that film Micromen that came out a couple years ago. And the last scene of the film with Clive just driving away from the Sinclair campus in a C5. What an amazing film. If you haven't seen that, you need to watch it. The problem with vehicles like the C5 is that the auto industry is always pushing bigger and bigger vehicles in general. So even the compact cars of today, like today's Mini Cooper or the modern Beetle, are so much bigger than their original counterparts, and it's because of safety. And that's the big problem that I have with a vehicle like the C5. If this thing is meant to go out on the open road, am I going to feel safe driving it in a lane across from a bus or a semi truck that's coming in the other direction? I don't think so. I wouldn't feel comfortable driving this around anything larger than a neighborhood or maybe a city park. Neil, you've driven a C5 on your channel. What was it like?
It was an experience, and it happened on a typically British day, wet, overcast. I was in this C5, which was pretty cramped. You've got these handlebars that actually go underneath your legs, so you're reaching down beneath your legs to steer this thing.
Comfy.
Comfy. You've got a thumb accelerator. But it was surprisingly fun. It did work well. But I did ride it on a cycle path, and there were far fewer of those in the 80s. You would have been riding it on the roads, and that's the purpose of it, to drive this thing on the roads, as you mentioned. Buses are a particularly scary thing. And I have seen that in the marketing for this new version, the e-trike, they've mentioned that the whole thing is higher up. So you sit higher up, not low down to the road, which was really scary to be close to those bus wheels low down.
Sure.
So the height might make you feel a bit safer. So it does try to address those issues as well as weatherproofing. It's a completely enclosed cockpit. And it's even got a rear view camera that pairs with your phone for reversing, which is quite neat. And while I didn't like the open cockpit in the rain of the original C5, I do wonder if this fancy-looking enclosed cockpit might actually give you a false sense of security when you're on the roads, because you've only got a few millimeters of fiberglass between you and that oncoming bus. So I do expect to see news stories when this thing comes out of people taking these onto the motorway before long. And the final selling point that I enjoyed when looking through this is that it's listed as having a built-in HEPA filter capable of catching a high percentage of microscopic particles, including many bacteria and viruses. And I checked this on the Wayback Machine, and it shows that that line of text didn't appear on the e-trike website months ago. It's a new addition. So marketing really ramping things up in the current climate of where we are in the world today. So there you go. It's a personal podule that you can drive around in and avoid that nasty virus.
You heard it here first. The C5 can protect you from COVID-19.
So if you're in the market for a new method of personal transportation, then the e-trike, the Iris e-trike, is now available for pre-order at £4,999, €5,490, or $6,197, and they expect to deliver it in quarter one of 2021.
Nintendo is releasing a 35th anniversary Super Mario Bros. Game & Watch. Nintendo's iconic Game & Watch series of portables were some of the first electronic games to actually offer a meaningful gaming experience. They were pioneers in the industry. The D-pad came from them, face buttons, all the familiar fixtures that you see on gaming controllers from the NES on were pioneered through the Game & Watch. These were developed by Gunpei Yokoi, who was the mastermind behind the Game Boy. And Nintendo released 59 of these things, which is a staggering amount, much more than I thought before I was doing research for this show. They were released between 1980 and the last one was released all the way up in 1991, well after the release of the Game Boy. Now, I know these things were pretty popular in hindsight, but when I was a kid, the only portable games like this I ever saw were the ones made by Tiger, and they were mostly horrible. Neil, did you ever see any Game & Watch games growing up?
Well, I have to start by agreeing with you. 59 Game & Watch games. If I had to take a stab in the dark, I would have said 20-something. I didn't realize it was quite that many.
Yeah.
But yeah, it really makes me laugh how collectible and expensive original Game & Watch games are now, because I do remember them. I remember them being tossed in kitchen drawers, thrown around in the bottom of toy boxes, being sold for 50p at local car boot sales or yard sales. They were everywhere. And even further afield in countries which were formerly Soviet states, such as Estonia, you find a whole range of cloned Nintendo Game & Watch devices, as I discovered recently when I made a virtual visit to Level Up, which is a computer museum over in Estonia. So yes, these things were ubiquitous as far as I can tell, and were practically disposable back then. But now they fascinate people, and I totally understand why. On the one hand, it's a Nintendo product. You have a thing that's small and durable and therefore easy to collect, which tells a part of the history of Nintendo. And that feels important. It feels like something that you should look after and collect. And on the other side of the coin, you have those Tiger devices, which again are small, durable and collectible, but they're so bad you want to look at them in the same way that you look at a car crash. And it's these two extremes of something that's perceived to be historically important or something that's so awful you can't explain why it even existed. Those are things that generally make things collectible, I think.
Yeah, I think that Nintendo is definitely riding the wave of collectability, following up on their series of mini consoles by going to the next natural thing, the Game & Watch series. So this coincides with the 35th anniversary of Super Mario Brothers. And unlike the original Game & Watches, this Game & Watch features a full color display and plays, you guessed it, Super Mario Brothers, as well as the game we knew in the West as the Lost Levels, but in Japan was known as Super Mario Brothers 2. In addition, the unit also plays a special version of the Game & Watch game Ball, which features Mario instead of Mr. Game & Watch. It's funny, the Game & Watch games always had very descriptive titles. It was like Ball, Fireman,
Cement Factory.
Right. You knew what you were getting into with Game & Watch games. But finally, it wouldn't be a Game & Watch without the watch. So the unit features a digital clock, which displays cute animations as well as the time. So, Neil, this thing is going to run around $50. Does this package appeal to you at all?
Well, you're going to be paying $50 for an original Game & Watch in nice condition these days. So I'll take this as an official Nintendo product for the collection. And I suspect anyone who collects the Game & Watch series is going to buy this, keep it pristine in its box, and display it as part of that official range of Game & Watch. I suspect it will mean, you know, you haven't got a complete set of Game & Watches now unless you've got this thing to add to the collection. And just as a complete aside, something I saw recently when researching those Soviet clones that I mentioned earlier is that they went as far as to take the game out of the Game & Watch. If you look on eBay, you can still buy these things, which look like a Nintendo Game & Watch. It's exactly the same form factor, a complete clone of the style, but all it does is the watch. It's a watch and watch. Four wow. large digits telling you the time is all you're getting. So there's no time for gaming in Soviet Russia, John.
But, that's just a joke waiting to happen.
But yeah, $50, I'll take one. I'm in.
I think the thing that appeals to me most about this whole thing is the clock. So maybe the Soviets aren't too far off in marketing these things as just clocks. Because let's face it, everybody's got everything that can play everything all the time. You know, I've got 15 things in my pocket right now that can play Super Mario Brothers. But I like the concept of being able to prop up this iconic piece of Nintendo history on my desk and look at it and have it tell me the time in an amusing way. When I visited Japan for the first time, I bought a 20th anniversary Famicom edition of the Game Boy Micro. And this thing looks almost exactly the same. I mean, of course, the Game Boy Micro is a little bit smaller. And, of course, looks like a Game Boy controller. But the color scheme was the same, the gold, the red, and the black design. That really ticks all my boxes. I love the design of the original Famicom. On the other hand, I was looking at a promotional picture of this in relation to a coffee mug, and this thing is way too small to actually use as a clock. You can't set this up on your dresser and, like, you know, as you settle into bed at nighttime, look up at it to see the clock. It's way too small for that. So as much as a sucker as I am for anything Nintendo, I think I'm going to give this one a miss. what I'd like to see is a relaunch of the original Game & Watch series that I could put on the wall, you know, I could put on the shelf next to my NES Black Box collection. Give me something to collect, Nintendo. Take my money. I want to see the full range. And you can make them $50, but make them, you know, one for one, the original with all the packaging. Sell them exactly as they were back in 1980. I would gladly pay for those.
Yeah, it's like what we were talking about last week with the collector's edition big box re-releases. Our appetite is much more for just a re-release of a big box game that looks exactly like it did back in the day with all the original contents. And you're desiring the same thing here. You don't want the extra bells and whistles and the new technology. You just want the chance to own a pristine version of one of these original Game & Watches. And I get that.
Without breaking the bank.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So thank you, Colony Activist, for sharing this story on our show subreddit.
How do you rank the top 20 greatest home computers? UK newspaper The Guardian has put out an article titled The 20 Greatest Home Computers Ranked. It's not an unusual blog post title, but it is notable seeing it in a national paper. And here is that top 20. So, John, if you've got any top 20 chart music, feel free to play it now. At 20, it's the Dragon 32 from 1982. At 19, it's the Atari ST from 1985. 18 is the Acorn Electron from 83. The Sinclair ZX81 comes in at 17th from 81. The Texas Instruments TI-99 is at 16th position from 1981. The Altair 8800, all the way back from 1975, is in 15th. The mighty Amstrad CPC from 1984 is in 14th position. The exotic Sharp X68000 from 1987 sits at 13th. The Apple Macintosh from 1984 sits in 12th. The MSX is in 11th place from 1983. In 10th is the Tandy TRS-80 from 77. The Commodore VIC-20 sits in 9th position and takes us into the top 10. The NEC PC-88 from 1982, I don't think I've ever seen one of those, is in 8th position. The Atari 800 from 1979 is in 7th. The Pride of Britain, the BBC Micro, sits in 6th place from 1981. But America beats it to the punch. The Apple II from 1977 is in 5th place. Britain fights back in 4th place with the ZX Spectrum 48K from 1982. And then it's a Commodore left-right. In 3rd place, it's the Commodore 64 from 82. In 2nd place, the Commodore Amiga, all the way up in 2nd place from 1985. And of course, in 1st place, the IBM PC from 1981. It's an eclectic and at times a surprising list, John. What stands out for you in that list?
The thing about a top 20 list of classic computers is that when you think about it, there's really only about 20 classic computers. In fact, they were sort of stretching here to fill out this list. The NEC PC-88, come on, what are we talking about here? So obviously, the author wanted to write an article that would get a lot of clicks. Anytime that you rank anything, it gets a lot of clicks. So what he's done is he's taken 20 computers and ranked them in the order that he likes them. I think on the whole, it's a pretty well-balanced list. There's proper representation from the British, American, and Japanese markets. But what are you ranking these by? If you're ranking them by sales, then the British computers fall off the list immediately. If you're going by influence, the Apple II was a good bit more influential than the C64 or the Amiga. I mean, it was the first major computer with expansion slots, typewriter-style keyboard, and affordable floppy controller. I could go on. But what this list is, again, is the author's favorite computers ranked in order of preference, which is exactly what I'd do if I was in charge of writing an article like this for The Guardian. I just rank my favorite computers, call it a top 20, and let the comment box overflow. What do you think, Neil?
Yes, this article does open with, "We remember the key PC machines that inspired a generation of gamers and programmers." And while I don't disagree that the Sharp X68000 is an incredible machine, I'm not sure how many people were actually inspired by it, how many actually had access to it, because it wasn't on sale outside of Japan. Likewise, the Dragon 32 is on the list, which was a commercial flop, but author Keith Stewart does add a caveat to that one in that he designed two hit games on it. So yes, he was inspired by the Dragon himself. John, what would be the most inspiring computer in your computer ownership history?
Oh, definitely my first computer, the Atari 1200 XL. It opened up the world of gaming and computers for me at a very young age. My dad bought it secondhand from a work friend when I was about 6 or 7 years old. And it was just an amazing feeling to be able to look at a television and be able to control things on a television. It's one of the most difficult things as a teacher for me to try and convey to my students because they've never known a world in which that wasn't possible. They've grown up in a world of interactivity. And so I really owe a lot to the 1200XL. And it's also the only machine from my youth that I still own the original of. Everything else I've bought and sold and rebought and sold over the years, but the 1200XL is built like a tank. It is still fully functional and I still use it to this day.
I'm not surprised, having explored the 800XL recently, which is, of course, is an extremely similar machine. I would have been inspired back then, just as I was with my Amstrad CPC 464 when I first got that. That was my first machine, and it was the same. It was that first generation of machines that we got where you took control of the pixels on a television. It's impossible to explain to kids these days how mind-blowing that was. So aside from feeling a bit sorry for the Atari ST being so low down on that list, which of course inspired many musicians, so I think that should have perhaps been a little bit higher, I think we can all agree that the Commodore Amiga in second place is the most excellent and totally accurate list that I've ever seen. So I think this should be stuck to as the law from now on. The Amiga's up there.
all the books need to be rewritten and the table of contents should just be that list in reverse order. Neil, Sid Meier has a new memoir out, and it's called Sid Meier's Memoir with an exclamation mark, just like Pirates, just like so many of his classic titles. If you've played any sort of turn-based or strategy game in the 80s or 90s, or even today, Sid Meier should be a very familiar name. It would be enough for any game developer to create Pirates, Railroad Tycoon, and Silent Service, but Civilization, the crown jewel, is now in its sixth sequel, and for the most part, each game is better than the last. As the programmers of gaming's golden age enter their, well, golden years, it's only natural that they sum up their lives on the page, and that's what Mr. Meier has done. Sid Meier's memoir, A Life in Computer Games, details Sid's early life, first exposure to video games, and his career trajectory, including some of his disastrous efforts to publish his games on consoles, before finally striking the right balance between lean-back and lean-forward gaming with Civilization Revolution for the Xbox 360. Neil, were you a Sid Meier fan back in the day? What were some of your favorite games by him?
I was certainly a fan of his, and still am. Railroad Tycoon was a huge one for me, and also Pirates. I think they were the two that had me completely hooked. In Pirates, I married every governor's daughter in every port around the globe.
As you should.
And Railroad Tycoon, that kept me busy for years. I would say up until Transport Tycoon, I think, took its crown. But it took many years for a game to come along and do that. And Transport Tycoon is a game that I still play today. So it took a lot to do that. How about you, John?
Well, none of Sid Meier's games actually came out for the Atari computers. And after that, I turned into a console kid. So I wasn't exposed to the majority of his oeuvre until I was older. However, with one exception, it was only when I was doing some research for this story that I found out that Sid Meier did Silent Service. I had no idea. I love that game, and I loved it on the NES. It's funny because he spends a lot of time talking about all the ways that it didn't work. But for me, that was as accurate a simulation as I'd ever played at the time. And I loved piloting my submarine around the waters and torpedoing ships and stuff. Maybe I was the only one. But anyway, Civ has to be my all-time favorite, especially Civilization IV. I played the heck out of that, and it's still probably the computer game I've logged the most hours on. Now, Neil, I know you have some experience with gaming history and publishing. You just published a book, a very successful Kickstarter, Retro Tea Breaks. Buy it now on newsstands everywhere. After all the folks you've had a chance to talk to as part of your Retro Tea Breaks series of podcasts and book, whose story would you like to see fleshed out as a full-fledged memoir?
Well, Sid Meier would certainly be up there. And I have to say as well, you're not the only one who enjoyed Silent Service. And progressing from that, I've got an ungodly amount of hours in my Steam library of having played Silent Hunter. So my addiction with that game carried through to more recent games. But, you know, we've got a lot of the big names that have done their memoirs. Richard Garriott did one a couple of years back. The Oliver Twins have done theirs. And then you've got other books like Masters of Doom, which goes really in depth with Romero and Carmack's Doom story. So a lot of them are already out there, but I would love personally to read the complete and definitive life story of Matthew Smith. So he was the creator of Manic Miner, a UK bedroom coder. And I'd like to read that because he really was a coding enigma as a teenager. And then he vanished famously for decades. And there was all kinds of speculation about where he was, what happened to him. And then he did reappear in recent years, looking like a man with a story to tell. And he was persuaded to give a talk at an expo last year, which I attended in Manchester, it was. They didn't really give him a huge amount of time to answer questions. We spent a lot of that watching a video that the organizers wanted to promote, which was a little bit painful because we were all there to hear what Matthew Smith had to say, and we had to watch this video. And he also had some trouble recalling some of the events, perhaps because of the pressure of an audience staring back at you. If it's not something that you do regularly, he must have been under a lot of pressure to recall things that he hadn't thought about for many years. So I would like someone to spend some time with Matthew Smith over a period of, let's say, a year, pop and visit him, make him a cup of tea, take him a chocolate bar, and have a nice relaxed chat with him to get as much information out of him as possible and build his memoirs and help us to understand what the man went through, because I think he's got a lot to tell.
I really hope you get the chance to do that, Neil. I think you're in a position now where you can say, hey, you know, I talked to Richard Garriott. I can talk to anybody, you know. So maybe we can look forward to that at least in a future retro tea break, if not a fully fledged memoir.
I'll certainly try my best, yeah. How about you, John? Who would you like to see a book from?
Miyamoto, most definitely. I checked Amazon because I couldn't believe that he hasn't written a memoir yet. There are lots of books about the iconic creator of Super Mario Brothers, The Legend of Zelda, Donkey Kong, and on and on and on, but none that he has written himself. So I'm hopeful that at some point he writes a book, although his career is still in full force. He's still a major driving factor at Nintendo, and I think he's one of gaming's greatest visionaries. If you're interested in reading a chapter of Sid Meier's memoir, you can head over to Ars Technica in the link of the show notes, and you can check it out there. It's available in print and audiobook format.
A controversial one now. Is it okay to spray paint retro computers? Restoring retro computers is always a fine balance of head and heart. How far do you go to get the machine to look just how you want it? Is retro brighting acceptable? Are destructive modifications okay, if they allow you to enjoy the machine more? It's a very personal decision, and the question raised today is it okay to paint those retro computers? And this is prompted by the release of a range of spray paints from RetroHacks.net, which appeared and then vanished from their website, but my understanding, having spoken to them, is that they were just figuring out how to ship compressed cans internationally, because there are certain rules on what you can and can't do with that. So I expect them to appear on sale again soon. Spray paints include Atari ST Grey, Amiga 500 Beige, and I have offered to help them by offering to send in a piece of an Amiga 1000 so that they can analyze and color match that so that they can produce spray paints for that machine. But is this something we should be doing? Should a yellowed old machine be left to wear its scars, or is it acceptable to paint them? I'd love to hear your opinion on that, John.
Neil, as you know, I'm a big fan of the patina. I like to see age on my systems. I don't even mind a little bit of battle damage on my systems. You know, these computers, these consoles, they are 30, knocking on 40 years old, knocking more than 40 these days. I want to see the story that they've told throughout the course of their life. I think I was the only one in the comments of your Atari 800 XL Trash to Treasure video who actually wanted you to 3D print a Mad Max style brake key for that system when you were restoring it. For some reason, I'm just one of these people that likes to see things in the condition that they arrive in. Now, when it comes to cleaning up systems, you know, wiping off the dust and the filth, yes, absolutely. I'm all for that. I'm also for any preventative maintenance that you can do, recapping machines, removing board batteries and replacing them so they don't explode and ruin the computer. That all that stuff is fine. But I draw the line at painting computers because in my experience, the chances of you actually improving the look of the computer by doing it is minimal. I'm sure that you've had experience with spray paint. Spray paint rarely does what you want it to do. You get too close, you get too far away, you overpaint, it gets runny, the surface texture changes. It's not an ideal solution. There's a reason why there are people that specialize in things like auto paint, because you can't do a professional job just at home with a can of spray paint. It's very, very difficult to do. And you only get one shot at this thing. You know, removing paint from computers is a nightmare. And I just think that the chances of you making it look worse far outweigh any gains that you'd get by making it look better. I'm interested to hear your thoughts, Neil, because restoration is definitely your thing.
It is. It's, you know, restoration of computers here in the cave is always an exploratory process. I'm always learning new things, and a lot of that learning comes through making mistakes. And I agree with you. There are a huge amount of mistakes that can be made through spray painting. The 3D printed key that John was referencing there was from an Atari 800 XL, which I was restoring recently. And the dilemma was the brake key was missing. And I did pitch the idea of 3D printing a brake key, a replacement key that was so obviously a 3D printed modern key that it sort of set itself apart. And you could say, okay, that's the old and that's the new part of the system. But fortunately, a viewer did send in a replacement brake key that I could drop straight in. But I kind of like that idea. I might do that in future with another machine. But specifically on spray painting, I really set out my stall when I did a video on it. I resprayed a very yellow BBC Micro, which was a case that I felt comfortable giving it a go on, partly because it's textured, so it'd be more forgiving of imperfections in the painting of it. And it did actually come out looking like new. I was pleased with the result, but I should say, as you mentioned there, I took it to a specialist car painter. So they knew what they were doing. They knew the temperature to have the paint at. They had all the things to hang the plastics.
Let me just take a shot in the dark, Neil. They didn't take a can and shake it up and just go to town.
Oh, no. They had it for like an hour in some hot water to make sure it was the right temperature. They had heaters under where we were hanging the plastics to make sure it dried evenly. They knew what they were doing. So I do agree with you very much that it can go horribly wrong if you try and do it yourself. And we also used spray paints that were specifically for the interiors of cars so that the oil from your hands wouldn't deteriorate the paint as it shouldn't do on, you know, inside a car. So we were very pedantic about the way we approached this. I do, on the flip side, also have a friend called Mark who makes a habit of taking really, really beaten up machines. Sometimes they even need filler to fix cracks and they've got holes in them. So he fixes all that up and then he sprays them very bright colors. So he sprayed a bright orange Commodore 64 and a bright yellow VIC 20. And that will have lots of people screaming when they see them. But you know what? They look amazing. They attract people to play on them. They're a talking point. It's a machine that would have ended up in the trash anyway.
Right. And here's the thing. There's no, it's not like those are the last two C64s and VIC 20s in the world.
No.
If there are any machines that are in danger of going extinct and mint copies, you know, falling through the tracks, those two machines are not examples.
Exactly. If they're produced in their millions and they're not in short supply, then, you know, have some fun with them. But out of interest, I did put a poll up on my Twitter account to see how other people felt about this. And I checked the results last night. At that point, there were 952 votes in, of which 57.7% of people are in favor of spray painting and 42.3% are not in favor. It's Brexit all over again, John.
It is.
And there were 77 comments left at that point. So lots of strong opinions for and against. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes and you can go and have a read of some of those. So keep an eye out on Retro Hacks. That's retrohax.net for those paints when they return on sale. And if you're on the side of the fence where spray painting is for you, then I doubt you'll get a closer color match than you'll find on their website for your micros. So thank you for listening to This Week in Retro. Join our show subreddit and contribute your favorite stories from the world of retro.
Help us spread the word about the show by leaving us a review on your podcast app of choice, sharing our Facebook page, or just telling a retro-loving friend. See you next week for more up-to-date news
for out-of-date tech.